Fairways of Life with author Matthew Adams.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thanks for joining us for another Golf Smarter podcast. We're going to have a lot of fun on today's show. We've got Kenny Nicholson, who's going to be doing Nick's Picks later on. He also is going to be announcing the winner of our drawing for the X500 Bushnell Rangefinder, and we'll also announce our next giveaway. But first, a new book called Fairways of Life, Wisdom and Inspiration from the Greatest Game. And the author is Matt Adams. Welcome, Matt.
Hello, Fred. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's an honor. Thank you.
You know, it's interesting because recently we've been asking our listeners to send us quotes about what keeps their head in the game when they're playing golf. And then across my desk comes your book, Fairways of Life, Wisdom and Inspiration from the Greatest Game. I mean, it's just not just great stories, but there are great quotes all through the book that I'm just going to happen to use on this show on a regular basis.
You know, the neat thing about the game of golf, as I'm sure you can appreciate, Fred, as you just were alluding to with your efforts to get great quotes, I find that the great champions of the game, almost universally, every time they speak, there is some nugget of wisdom. There is some insight into the method that they use mentally. And in my book, you'll look through, you talk about the quotes in there from Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus or Gary Player or Walter Hagen or Bobby Jones, et cetera, et cetera. And there are some great ones that I like to use it to try to pull a particular theme, a chapter together, to kind of weave together the whole tapestry of the theme of the book, Fairways of Life. But it even goes beyond that. You know, I was working yesterday. I'm a columnist and reporter for the Golf Channel, among my writing. And I was up at the TPC Boston. That was the event that I was assigned to. And they have a segment that they call Mic'd Up, where we put a wireless microphone on a PGA Tour player, and I stand off camera, and I have a conversation with them. It's similar to what you and I are doing right now, really. And I love to ask these guys to look them in the eye and say, what motivates you? What keeps you going? When you've been out here for years and years, and you've played hundreds or perhaps thousands of golf tournaments and rounds of golf, what keeps you going through all that? And it's amazing some of the answers that you get from the guys. And I was talking with a young golfer named Charlie Hoffman yesterday. And classic guy. He's got blonde hair down to his shoulders, and he has a Titleist hat on that looks like, you know, it's one of those retro trucker's hats, as they call it, with the mesh behind it.
Oh, the kids love those, right?
And I was saying to Charlie, I said, you know, what's in it for you? What's your motivation? I mean, how do you keep yourself going week after week? Because it is a physical grind, not to mention a mental grind. And he said, you know what it is, Matt? He said, I make sure I have fun. He said, this isn't a job to me. I mean, how hard is it to play golf every day? He said, you know, yeah, it's, you know, the travel can get a little bit tough. He said, but I'm out here having a good time. I'd make sure that I maintain the attitude that this isn't work, this is fun. I just happen to get paid for it. And I thought that was a very, very healthy attitude. There was another interesting run-in that I had with a fellow named Robert Carlson, who's playing on the European Ryder Cup team. He's from Sweden. And I had a similar conversation to him, except, you know, he's having this fantastic year. He's winning tournaments all over the world. He qualified for the European Ryder Cup team straight away, not having to obviously be a captain's pick or what have you. And I said to Robert, I said, how do you hit the shot? You're coming down to the end of a tournament. It's a must do situation. You have to pull this shot off to continue to either maintain a lead or gain the lead or what have you. And he looked at me and he said, Matt, I don't distinguish. He said, to me, the last shot in your round is just as important as the first shot, which I thought was an incredible perspective. So he said, I keep it in perspective. I make sure that I don't put any more weight on that shot on the 72nd hole than I do in the shot where I've got to save par in the first hole on Thursday. And it was just an amazing perspective and how you start to get inside the head of these world champions and start to realize how they think versus the way that perhaps you and I think when we're out on the golf course and we'd start to panic and the knees start to knock over that final putt.
Well, that's why I was going to ask you, why isn't it always fun for us?
Well, I think it's not only us. I mean, these guys admitted that the pros go through it as well, but golf is a tough game. Yes. It's a hard game to execute. No one can deny that. Anyone that's involved in the game realizes that. That's why, you know, on my end, where I started in the equipment industry, that's why that industry can continue to exist year after year, because we, I believe, as golfers, are all eternal optimists, and we all believe our next round will be better than our last, and that we can go out and get a piece of equipment that will help actualize a slice into a slight draw or a long straight ball or what have you. So the game can wear you down at times, and I think that's one of the advantages of the writing that I do. When I wrote Fairways of Life, part of the lessons that are in there, because it's I have to admit, Fred, it's a combination of many things. I write for a series called Chicken Soup for the Soul. That's the book series that I'm a co-author of.
And that's really awesome. Now, is there a Chicken Soup for the Soul of golf?
Yeah, we did a book a few years called Chicken Soup for the Golfer's Soul.
Okay.
It is the best-selling golf nonfiction of all time. It's just an amazing testament to the fervor of golfers, if you will.
Wow.
And also to certainly that Chicken Soup for the Soul brand. And it's really an honor to be one of their co-authors.
Well,
I'm not involved in every book, but they assign me to the particular ones.
We hope that Fairways of Life catches up with it.
I certainly hope that would be wonderful. But what happens with Chicken Soup for the Soul is we get all these wonderful, inspiring stories, which for me as an author, it convinces me that our charity of spirit needs to be fed. We all need to know that there is goodness in the world, that we're not alone, that our human experience, regardless of how tough it can be on a daily basis, that it is a common experience. We all go through ups and downs and peaks and valleys, and we all have to live life, good or bad. And that the game of golf, I believe, becomes an almost microcosm of how we live our lives. Do you approach every day with a foreboding sense of battling the day? Are you the guy that's going to stand out on the point of the ship and swing wildly at the approaching hurricane? Or are you the type of person that embraces life? Are you the type of person that takes the bounces, if you will, in golf, good or bad, with a smile and realize that even when something happens that you may not deem to be to your advantage, there is a way that you can enjoy the experience, and there is a way that you can recover from the experience and perhaps take joy in your efforts to recover as well? How many times have you heard golfers on the golf course, I'm talking about professional golfers, who will, in their post-round press conference, will say, well, what happened on 14? And the guy will say, oh, that was a really good par, or that was a really good bogey. Now, here's a guy that may have shot 10 birdies in the golf course during the round, but he'll note a par or even a bogey or worse as being quote-unquote good because it, in essence, saved their round. There was some adversity that they faced that they fought their way through, and Tiger Woods is brilliant at this. He does it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They fought their way through the adversity, and at the end of the day, arguably, you could look at that and say, he wouldn't be where he is if he wasn't able to save par from the right rough or from on top of the clubhouse roof or what have you. So, you know, that's part of that perspective. And I think that's why the game of golf, just like the game of life, can wear us down. And at times it isn't fun. And at times we have to deal with loss, and at times we have to deal with adversity. But I think the game of golf is very unique in that it allows us to realize these universal lessons that even if you've double bogeyed a hole or blown a shot out of bounds, you have the chance of birdie in the next hole. It's as much a question of mental posture as it is execution.
Well, here's a great quote from Jack Nicklaus in the book. Ask yourself how many shots you would have saved if you never lost your temper, never got down on yourself, always developed a strategy before you hit, and always played within your capabilities.
Isn't that brilliant? And that's part of what I talk about in terms of the wisdom that's inherent in the words of these great champions. You know, Jack Nicklaus, to my knowledge, does not promote himself as a traveling wise man, as someone that you go to the mount for the wisdom of Jack Nicklaus. Yet, if you read his quotes, any interview he ever does, when you read the stuff that he says, it is so applicable to the game of golf and to the game of life at large. Take that same quote and apply it to your life.
Mm-hmm.
How successful could we be if we thought through every decision, if we sat back and didn't weigh ourselves down with worry and emotion and anxiety, if we had a plan that we were operating on in terms of what we wanted to accomplish and how we were going about doing it? That's what I love about these guys, and that's why I wrote Fairways of Life, because I think it allows us to have this common vision, this vision that is very, very unique to the game of golf. I like to say to people, Fred, that it doesn't matter whether your fairways are lined with, you know, green grass or with marble. The lessons from the game can carry beyond the fairway. And that's why it was so exciting. That's what's really connecting with a lot of people, in that I don't think that the concept that Fairways of Life is based upon, this idea that we can learn lessons from life, from the game, is unique. In fact, I think it's incredibly universal, and that's why the book is doing well, and that's why I'm getting a lot of notes and letters and emails from all over the world, because we're tapping into this universal theme, this sense that people already have about golf.
Absolutely. So how did you get this perspective? I mean, you don't just walk around whistling all the time, I hope.
No, I believe that the source of this perspective for me, as I'd mentioned, was really my experience as a Chicken Soup for the Soul author.
Mm.
And I think as a Chicken Soup for the Soul author, because we're dealing in many cases, you know, the first book that I did for Chicken Soup for the Soul was called Soul of America, which we wrote in response to the 9/11 attacks for the benefit of the New York Area Relief Fund. Well, you know, obviously, from the subject matter alone, that was not something that could be taken lightly. That was a very, very serious subject, a very weighty subject, and emotionally it was a roller coaster to be involved in the book, not to mention what we all went through universally with that and unfortunately the people who were directly affected. So what it showed, though, I believe, is that in the actions of other people and in the emotions of other people, there is this universal goodness within us. There is a core of goodness within people. And that was the approach that I took with doing Fairways of Life. And I said, you know, this game of golf inspires a passion. Golf is somewhat unique in that, you know, people are described as, oh, my father, he's a golfer, or my brother, he's a golfer. And I started to take a look at it, and I said, what does that mean, to quote-unquote be a golfer? And I found out it was more than just the way that we dress, which has been maligned over the years, for example. It is a lifestyle. It's an all-encompassing perspective. And that's what I wanted to capture. Now, I'm not suggesting that every single golfer is an optimist, and when you sit next to them, as you just noted, they're whistling their way through life. I'm not suggesting that at all, but I am suggesting that we all can move closer to that particular road. We all can benefit from better perspective of our golf game, better perspective of our game of life. And that was the kind of stories that I put into Fairways of Life, so that, you know, people could read the book, perhaps get a smile on their face, better yet, sit back and kind of contemplate and meditate on the message and say, you know, these great champions faced a world of adversity just like I am. They faced self-doubt. They faced adversity of many various kinds, not the least of which is what may happen to their golf ball on the golf course, but it also happened with incidents off the course as well. And I also tried to put in a good dose of humor into the book as well, because I think that's a large part about the game of golf. I think, if anything, golf provides you with plenty of opportunities to recognize the ironies that constantly come up in the universe. Because I think, I think we're all being pushed in a particular direction where we should really lighten up in general in life and enjoy life a lot more and smile and laugh a lot more. And there's, if you can't do that with golf, then yeah, it can make you miserable.
Well, here's a quote from Amy Alcott in your book. Keep your sense of humor. There's enough stress in the rest of your life to let bad shots ruin a game you're supposed to enjoy.
And I think that's a good message. That that chapter in particular I wrote towards young golfers, because it's been kind of an interesting phenomenon that I've noticed in my 20 years in working in the golf industry, that over the last 5 or 10 or 15 years, I'm noticing more and more young people who come off the golf course with a scowl on their face. And I don't know whether it's the pressure that they're placing upon themselves, or whether it's genesis is from coaches or parents or what have you, but there's this sense from young golfers that they need to play the game with this certain perfection, where I believe that golf is more a game of managing your mishits than it is expecting everything you hit to be perfect.
Is Tiger putting too much pressure on them?
He may be, but it's interesting. If you listen to the words of Tiger, if they're trying to emulate his success, but if you listen to the words of Tiger, like after in the Open Championship, I forget what his round was. I think if memory serves me, it was a 64. And there was an interview that I saw in Tiger, obscure interview I picked up off the internet, and they said to him, you know, you must hit great shots out there. And he said, I only hit about 3 good shots, which was a really interesting perspective. He said, I only hit about 3 good shots. He said, after that, it was basically managing my misses. And I thought that even in that has a tremendous amount of wisdom in it that I think we can that's a message I'd like to impart to young people, that you don't need to be perfect. What it's about is maintaining the perspective, the fight through the adversity and exploit it to take advantage of the situation versus expecting yourself to be perfect all the time, because you can't do it. In any facet of life, on the golf course or otherwise, we are not perfect beings. We cannot be perfect. So it's really a question of lightening up in yourself, allowing yourself to be human, and then working through the adversity and trying to take advantage of the opportunity that it then presents.
Absolutely. I was explaining to my son the other day that watching Tiger, it's more about his creativity out there that I find astounding than anything else.
He has a tremendous mental discipline, Fred, doesn't he, that he just doesn't give up.
Got to love those Stanford kids. Well, now you have an interesting perspective as well in your work history around golf. It's not just ESPN and the Golf Channel. Mm-hmm. You worked in the golf industry as well, right?
Well,
tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, my career, if you will, in the golf industry started in manufacturing. So,
and how did you end up in broadcasting from that?
I actually started in broadcasting. I started working in radio when I was still in high school. And I would get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd run down the radio station and I'd edit my piece. You know, the days when we used to use the old reel-to-reel, and you'd literally...
I got one sitting right next to me here.
Yeah, and you used to edit with a razor blade.
I haven't gotten rid of it yet.
Remember the razor blade edits? You'd cut, and then you'd splice them together. And
oh, yes.
I mean, those days, right?
I love those days.
I'm 42, but that was started when I was 18.
Dude,
so.
I've got so many years. I got so many razor blade stories that I couldn't repeat. I worked in rock and roll radio in the 70s, so I don't want to tell you about razor blade stories.
See? So you know better than I.
Yes,
but
sir.
That's how I started. I started doing radio.
Okay.
Went to college. I kept it going. I started to work for ESPN, and I worked in the production department in the late 80s, and there was still this young network with, you know, a lot of people were working out of trailers, the different shows and offices. And I worked with them for a few years and loved it and learned a ton about television production, sports television production. I then left to work for a sports promotion company who had a client that was in the golf industry. The guy who was president of the company had a heart attack, and they said to me, would you come down, would you be interested in learning golf manufacturing? So I did, and that was 1990. And I went down there, and I had spent summers working in golf and working at country clubs and so forth, so I knew the green grass side of the industry, the on-course side, if you will. But now I learned manufacturing, and I worked in that for many years, and I kind of learned it from the ground up. You know, when I first went down there, it was just the end of the persimmon era. Still had a lot of persimmon clubs that were coming through repair and so forth, and learned how to make them wound and turn them down and all that business that goes into it. But then we shifted into steel and then titanium and right on through. So it was in that capacity, Fred, that as this little network that was starting in Orlando called the Golf Channel started up, here they had a guy in me that knew media, knew how to handle himself from a media standpoint, but also knew the intricacies of the golf industry and in particular knew golf equipment technology. That's how the whole process began. And that kind of, if you will, molded me into my media personality in terms of golf. And then I started somewhere along the way, when they were doing Chicken Soup for the Golfer's Soul, I got contacted by those guys and they said, hey, we've seen what you do. Could you do some writing for us? And I did. I started out ghostwriting for them in golf, and that just one thing led to another. And
were you always writing up to this point? I mean, I can't imagine anyone, because I've been in broadcasting and media and that kind of stuff for a long time. I can't imagine going, can you write for us?
I mean, well, you know what I think it is? I don't put a great deal of weight upon my ability to write. I look at writing as writing. And you know from your radio experience that it required you to write. In radio, of course, we used to write what they call voicers, you know, these 30-second voicers or one-minute voicers. And you kind of got used to knowing how many words you had to write longhand on a sheet of paper, and that would be about 30 seconds to recap a particular event. And to me, that's writing. Whatever you do, as long as you do it all the time, you're going to hopefully improve at it. And I think
it's a very different kind of writing. You're not writing. When you write for broadcast, grammar pretty much goes out the window because you're trying to communicate, right? But when you're writing for print, it's a different beast, I think.
It can be a different beast unless you have good editors, which I've been very fortunate to have, which I always like to say they can turn my slop into the Queen's English. So what I did was I went into writing for books and periodicals and magazines and newspapers the same way as I did it for radio. And my only guiding principle, if you will, when I write, and I think hopefully Fairways of Life embodies this, is that I want to be able to write the way I speak. And what I mean by that is not so much in my particular vernacular, but from the perspective that if someone picks up something that I have written, like if someone gets a copy of Fairways of Life and reads my book, they're going to feel like they're sitting and we're having a conversation. And what's more, and I think this has helped me with my Chicken Soup for the Soul writing for that book series, but also in Fairways of Life, is when I write something, I don't try to write it from the perspective that, from a highbrow perspective, that I am preaching to someone. What I'm trying to grasp is the universal. I'm trying to touch a nerve that, even if sometimes if it's buried beneath layers of self-doubt or frustration, that somebody connects with it and they go, you know what, I feel the same way. That connects with my emotion, because I believe that we all are essentially the same in terms of our emotions. We all have this need to feel loved. We all want to feel as though we are contributing to the lives of others and to the world at large. And we all want to have this kind of common communal support in terms of how we progress day to day. I just think it's a natural human instinct. And those are the type of things that I like to tap into with my writing. So, you know, I've been very fortunate and have had a lot of people say, you're a wonderful writer, but I don't really look at it as something that I place upon a noble threshold. I simply say all I'm trying to do is write from the heart, who I am, who my message is, and hope that it connects with another person.
And what's the name of the book again?
My book?
Yeah.
Fairways of Life.
I just wanted to make sure we get that in there.
well done.
Mr. Subliminal Man. Okay, let's get back to the book. Enough about you, Matt. You've got some great stories in here, but you also have some contributions from some pretty well-known people. How'd you do that?
Well, I think it's the nature of the game of golf itself, if you will, that you bump into all these wonderful people as you go down the road. And because I was in Orlando and I was in manufacturing down there, and down the road from where I worked was Bay Hill, so I got to know Arnold Palmer.
Wow.
And, you know, it's an incredible honor to be around a legend like that. You just want to be around him. I mean, just hang out with him and see how he acts and how he treats people. And he's as you know, and I'm sure you've had other people on your show, Fred, that have talked about Arnold Palmer, he is an incredibly gracious person. And it's amazing to me that with the demands on his time, the way that he will shake your hand and the way that he will look you in the eye and the way that he will connect with whatever it is that you're talking about and give you that snippet. You know, he's a guy that you hear all these great stories about Arnold Palmer, where he would come to the tee box and he would scan the people in the gallery and he would make eye contact with someone and kind of give them a little nod of the head and say hello. I mean, amazing story. I talked to a guy recently that was outside the golf industry, but he was telling me a story that he was in Europe in the early 70s and he happened to have been over there during a Ryder Cup. He and his wife went to the Ryder Cup, and of course it wasn't the spectacle that it is now, so you could walk alongside of the players, and you know, he saw Arnold Palmer there, and Arnold Palmer said, oh, you guys are Americans, and was talking with him. We showed up the next day again. Arnold Palmer gave them both a big hug, shook hands with him, and you know, this guy has this amazing capacity to connect with people despite the fact that he's a massive superstar. So yeah, it was really neat, and Mr. Palmer agreed to do the foreword to the book, and I thought that was, I'm still blown away by it, Fred,
sure.
To tell you the truth.
It's just really a different era, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's just...
That'd be very hard to do. I mean, Tiger carries himself so well, but he's also really protected.
He is, but part of that is just the nature of his personality. Now, someone could say, no, it's mandated by necessity. However, if you spend any time around Arnold Palmer, where everybody in the world has a pen out for him and demanding of his time, he's got this incredible capacity to, even if it's a fraction of a second, connect with you. Yeah. He's got this charisma about him that even if he's just walking past you in the gallery, you feel like he's a friend of yours. It's more than just seeing him on some lofty plateau. I don't know another person I've ever met like that, quite frankly.
Oh, Barry Bonds, absolutely.
Indeed. But Arnold Palmer has that ability, Fred. It's really incredible, and
awesome.
I think we're very, very, very fortunate to be living at a time when the great champions of the game of golf, whether it was Sam Snead or Gene Sarazen, Ben Hogan. You know, we're of an age where we were able to see these guys while they were still here, and to hear their stories and to see them at special events. So I love the opportunities you have. I don't care if it's a made-for-TV event, but to be able to see Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player and Arnold Palmer still hitting the golf ball and playing, we're literally watching a big chunk of a significant chunk of the history of the game right in our midst.
Yeah, but you got Arnold Palmer to do the foreword of your book. I mean, that's a little more than a nod and a handshake.
It's really, really cool. I think, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, Fred, that there is a universal themes that are inherent to the game of golf. And when Mr. Palmer knew what the book was about, this idea that there are lessons from the game that carry beyond the fairway, he immediately connected with it because obviously it's something he believes in. Now, here's a guy that lost his wife to cancer. Here's a man that fought through prostate cancer himself. Here's a man that kicked the habit of smoking and has a campaign to get people to stop smoking. And I just think to myself, with all that this guy has gone through, the ups and downs of life, the realities that affect all of us in one way, shape, or form, and yet he takes it and he's able to put it on a platform to say, you know what, man, go out and get yourself checked so that you make sure that you don't get prostate cancer or, God forbid, catch it early if you do. Or just to look into a camera and say, I gave up smoking, so can you. And the thought that ran through my head, and I write about it in one of the stories in the book, Fred, is that how many lives has Arnold Palmer saved? Not how many lives has he touched with the joy of the game of golf, but how many lives has he saved by people who heard his message and said, you know what, that's smart, I hadn't thought about it, but if Arnold Palmer could get prostate cancer, I can get prostate cancer, I'm going to go get it checked. And so that was all the stuff that I think it was in all those areas that Mr. Palmer connected and said, yes, he would do the forward for Fairways of Life as a result.
Well, maybe that's why he was brought here in the first place, to help
you
us
wonder,
all out.
Yeah. Wonder, but I'm convinced that his efforts have indeed resulted in saving lives.
Sure. Oh, that's awesome. You also have Donald Trump. Now, that's not someone you're going to meet while you're doing manufacturing, is it?
I didn't meet him through manufacturing. I actually met Mr. Trump through the greengrass side of the business because what I do now is golf course operations. And the Trump organization is getting, as you know, they have, what, 5 golf courses now, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
They're getting very aggressive in looking at different golf facilities and making sure that, you know, they really fit with the Trump name and brand, et cetera. They're doing a massive project, I think, in Aberdeen, Scotland, right now. So there was a property that they were looking at that I was involved in consulting on the ops side. And so I just got to know his people, and we hit it off. There's a woman named Carolyn Kepcher, who she's on The Apprentice. She sits to his left,
blonde woman,
right, as you look at it. Yeah. And she runs his golf division. And so Carol,
right?
And I hit it off.
Oh, okay.
We kind of had this, there was some synergy and similarity in terms of what we do, because now she was doing this TV show, yet 9 to 5 she was running these golf operations. And so I kind of got to know everybody with the Trump organization. And I was in New York one day because I was getting a new literary agent, is what happened. And some of the Trump people said, when are you coming in and so forth, and called me on my mobile and said, can you come over to Trump Tower? Mr. Trump would like to meet you, which I thought was really kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I went down there, and they led me up to the whatever floor we went up on Trump Tower. I don't even remember. And then you go through this, like, myriad of hallways, and it was like catacombs of hallways, which I'm sure, because these guys are brilliant in their negotiating, they do on purpose. As you walk through, the walls are covered with magazine pictures of Mr. Trump and this and that, and you clearly, as you're going through this hallway, get the impression that he's a very, very important guy, if you didn't already know that. And so I went in and sat down in his chair, and he said, oh, my people tell me a lot of great things about you. You know, sounds like you're doing a lot of neat stuff. And we shook hands and talked for a few minutes. And he said, okay, it was nice to meet you. And I left. That was it. That was how it happened.
Wow.
We struck up a friendship. And when this book was coming out, I asked him if he would look at it and give it a read and let me know what he thinks. And that's how he got involved.
Have you played golf with him?
I haven't played golf with him, to tell you the truth. I think I'd like to.
Yeah. I think it'd be fun. Things that I've read about his round of golf, it's his rules, but Listen, it's the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules, right?
Well, if it's on his golf course, I would respect his rules.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's put on our fuzzy slippers. Tell us a story. let's you know, gather around the campfire here, and Matthew's going to tell us a story. What's your favorite stories from this book?
No, I'll tell you honestly, I'll tell you something I haven't said in any other interviews before. When you put together a book, it's kind of like putting together a puzzle. And that a lot of people believe that when you write a book, you write it from chapter one. And in my book, I have 9 chapters going out and then 9 chapters coming in and separated in themes. You know, I want to do 18 chapters. And people assume that you write it from chapter one to chapter 18. Well, I didn't do that. And I don't know any other authors that really do. Books kind of come together in pieces.
Well, this is a compilation as well. It's not necessarily a story, right?
Yeah, well, about 95% of it was really literally my pen talking, but there were a couple stars. George White is in there, and Mark Cubbage, George White is a columnist with GolfChannel.com, and Mark Cubbage runs the World Golf Hall of Fame Museum, and they had these incredibly good stories that I wanted to include, and I figured, you know, it's my book, so I'm going to put it in. But when you sit down and you're ready to put the book together, I thought that I was done. And so I sat down and I pulled together all these different chapter elements from Word, my Word documents and my different computers, and looked at it and said, you know, I'm feeling good, and counted it up, and I had 17 chapters. Realized I didn't have the final chapter. I had to come up with, you know, what was going to be my final chapter. So I sat back and I put on some Celtic music and had a not-so-cold Guinness, and said, well, what am I going to do? How am I going to close this book? And I decided that the last chapter, the 18th chapter, the missing chapter, if you will, would be one that would be about golf kind of as a lifelong journey, this kind of a culminating chapter, if you will, Fred, that kind of touches on this, on the universal, if you will, that I've talked about, that I think the game touches on. And through time and place, and the Irish music and the Guinness, I wrote a chapter that was basically about my father and how he had introduced me to the game, the sentry at the gate of the game of golf, if you will, and introduced me to something that had become a lifelong passion of mine. And I think that is a fun chapter to read, because I think it connects with a lot of people, whether the people that introduced them to the game were their fathers, their grandfathers, or their mother, or whoever it was. And if you don't mind, I would love to read you a little passage from that chapter.
That would be great. It's like your own personal Shivas Irons, huh?
Yes. Not that I have anywhere near the expertise in that regard as Michael Murphy. I think Michael is a true, true, true hero of mine. And I know that you've talked to Michael and Steve Cohen and the people at the Shivas Iron Society, but that man is a person that I honestly believe is a genius, and I think that his writing has so many layers and so much depth to it that for me, I've read Michael's book out of joy alone, but I've had to read it as well at least 5 times just to try to get a sense of where he's going with some of the stuff, because it is so deep. And I would say that in advance that I don't even claim to be in the realm that Mr. Murphy is in, but man, I think he's just the best, absolutely the best. But this is from a story within chapter 18 that's actually called A Lifelong Journey, and I'll pick up in one of the chapters there.
Cue the music.
What my dad really taught me to appreciate in the game of golf were the more esoteric aspects of the game, those elements that are not played out in the form of 300-yard drives or birdie putts from downtown. My father taught me that golf is a lifelong love affair. It begins with an infatuation, develops into a senseless love, and matures into a contentious, maddening, frustrating, exhilarating, fulfilling, and yet understanding kind of bond you see in an elderly couple in the park. It is difficult to describe why the addicting game of golf is so endearing. I believe it is because the game allows us a glimpse of perfection. How often have you endured a horrible round replete with proclamations of quitting the game, only to be saved by that one miraculous shot that keeps you coming back? While it may not come with the same frequency for most of us as it does for the finest golfers in the world, the game does not discriminate in allowing our aspirations to perfection. Why a first-time golfer could sink a 60-foot triple breaker or chip in for par. Each of us has the capacity to hit a shot with the same results as the best the game has ever known. And what's more, golf allows us the opportunity to sometimes perform these feats on the same golf course walked by the game's legends. What other sport would allow such an experience? In our quest to master a game that cannot be mastered, golf is foremost about self-discovery. A person is revealed to the world in a round of golf. Even more so, we are revealed to ourselves. Our character, integrity, and morality are all put to the test, and our ability to handle pressure is put to the fire. Sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail, and if we are observant, each time we learn something new, something to keep us coming back. It is for all these reasons and more that golf is a game that mirrors life. Golf is both a mystical journey of joy and sorrow and a physical journey of cause and effect. It is a game providing us with opportunities for wonderfully torturous choices. Take a chance and achieve supreme glory or wallow in dismal failure, always with the promise of another day to try again. To be a golfer is to be an optimist, for we all believe that our next round will be better than our last. We are always striving for more. In fact, it is game's elusive nature that makes it all the more appealing. Ultimately, the game leaves us with more questions than answers and presents a fascinating dichotomy that keeps golf fresh and new despite its ancient origins. My dad was right. Golf truly is a love affair, a journey of a lifetime.
The book is called Fairways of Life, Wisdom and Inspiration from the Greatest Game, and our guest was and is Matthew Adams. Matthew, Matt, that was awesome.
Thank you, Fred. It was. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to speak to me. It was fun.
Oh, well, best of luck with the book. We advise everyone, give it as a gift after you buy it for yourself, because it's the kind of thing that you'll be able to talk about with your friends after reading. And you know how I feel about golf quotes, okay? So this is going to be used for quite a while now, and I'm sure people are going to be sending me quotes out of the book saying, use this one.
I hope they do. I love to hear back from people. I love to hear their response, because I think ultimately golf is a game of companionship. It's a game that it's not just for us. It's a game we share. And so I love to hear people's response and how the game has affected them.
Well, you can email me and I'll forward it off to Matt if you want.
Sounds wonderful. Fred, thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Matt.
Golf Smarter now presents Nick's Picks with Kenny Nicholson, sales manager for EdwinWattsGolf.com. Kenny keeps us up to date with reviews of new products and new product development. Nick's Picks is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968.
Hey, Kenny, how are you?
Doing good, Fred. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really good. You got something magical in your bag today?
Absolutely, I do.
What's that?
I wanted to try to talk today about the difference between a forged and cast and a muscle back and cavity back golf clubs for you.
Well, that's good, because if somebody's in the market to buy new clubs, they need to understand the difference, right?
They absolutely do. It's one of those things where we get the question a lot, you know, what type of club do I need to be playing? What is the difference between a forged and a cast golf club? Things of that nature that we might be able to help out with today.
Go for it.
Forged is what I want to cover first. Just the process real quick at the way forging is made. It's basically a raw piece of steel. It looks like a piece of angle iron almost, and they forge the golf club out of this piece of steel. It gets heated to be made that way, but it never gets heated to a liquid form, so it holds its purity. It doesn't ever lose its grain or its flow, so it gives it a much more solid golf club. That being said, they also make those in a traditional muscle back style usually, and it's not as forgiving as a cast club.
And a cast club?
A cast club is basically some type of stainless steel that's melted to a liquid form and poured into a cast mold. So once you heat something up, the molecular structure of the metal obviously has changed. But at the same time, that's the only way that they can make cast golf clubs.
Oh. And then a third?
That's really, a lot of companies, what they've gone to is what's called a double heat treat, where once they heat the metal to a liquid form and then they cool it, the molecules set in a certain place. And what they try to do is they reheat this not to a liquid form, but they heat it up enough to get the molecules to float around, and then they super cool it. And what that does is it gives the iron a more consistent feel. And people ask us all the time, you know, is Callaway, Ping, TaylorMade, all these other companies, are they better than the generic brands that are on the market? And the answer to that is they are, because they spend a lot more money in research and development, and they spend a lot more money in a finished product.
And does one make a difference whether you're a high handicapper or a low handicapper?
They do, without a doubt. A low handicap golfer that can use what we call a muscle back or a blade type golf club, and you can picture this, if you're looking at a 2-iron, it's like looking down at a butter knife. They tend to have a little bit higher swing speed, a little bit better ball striker. The center of gravity is not as low in that golf club, so what the typical player might have a problem doing is getting the ball airborne. A guy that's a real good golfer that can play a muscle back golf club is able to get the longer irons up in the air no problem.
Okay, and then a high handicapper.
Medium to high. Medium handicappers can play a what we call a cavity back, which is the back of the golf club's cut out, and they move that weight down towards the bottom to help get the ball airborne. Now, they do make cavity backs for better players, and they do make cavity backs for higher handicaps. The big difference between the two is the amount of offset at the bottom of the golf club. Offset, if you look down straight with the shaft, the face is going to be set back just a little bit. And what this typically does is it helps get the person's hands in front of the golf ball, which is going to help you get lift as well. So a cavity back for a better player is not going to have as much offset as a cavity back for a higher handicap player. And then for a higher handicap player as well, you're going to see a little more of a cavity in the back of the club and a little bigger sole, which gets more weight down towards the bottom, especially on the long irons.
And this is not the type of purchase you want to make by just going, looking at the club, thinking it looks cool, and walking away with it. You really need to be fitted. You need to work with a professional, right?
Yeah, the chances of you walking into a store and just looking at a set of golf clubs that look nice and being able to play them, it's hard to say if it's going to be correct for you. If I can say this, if I'm going to make a purchase and spend that kind of money on golf clubs, I'm either going to want to be fitted or try some demos and try to find out what's best for me. The best way to do it is to call Edwin Watts Golf or go by one of our stores and have one of our professionals fit you or talk to you over the telephone and try to guide you in a direction that you need to be in. You don't want to go in there and try to guess, because the chances are you might guess wrong.
And if you do live in a place where you can't walk into an Edwin Watts Golf store, you can go to your local shop. They'll fit you. You can take those measurements, and then you can call into Edwin Watts Golf.
Yeah, we do that all the time. Every day we have people call us and say, hey, I was fitted by my local professional. This is what I need. We can have the golf club shipped directly to you from the manufacturer, and our account status with them is usually higher than anybody out there. So they ship usually within 12 to 24 hours.
So the number at Edwin Watts Golf to call would be 1-800-874-0146.
That is correct.
And if you mention the Golf Smarter podcast, you're going to get free shipping. So you're going to be saving lots of money on not only the purchase, but on the shipping, and probably you may not have to pay sales tax if you're calling from out of state. But I didn't say that. But again, mention the Golf Smarter podcast, or you can go online at edwinwattsgolf.com/golfsmarter. And also, during the month of October, you're going to get 10% off any footwear and free shipping of any purchase that you make. We right on that, Kenny?
That is correct, Fred.
Okay, now we still have some more business to take care of, and that is our giveaway. For the last 3 weeks, we've been talking about giving away a Bushnell X500 rangefinder, and it's time for our drawing. We have received entries from the Netherlands, Australia, Canada, England, Japan, France, Brazil, New Zealand, Singapore, and, of course, all those servicemen overseas. Thank you so much for listening and for entering. We have 121 entries, Kenny.
Wow, that's awesome.
I know, it really is. And for those people who've entered a second time, thank you for coming back. You know, it's like golf. You just got to keep plugging away. You're going to win sooner or later. So we got 1 to 121. Kenny, pick a number, and our winner is?
Number four.
And that would be Robin Doty of Alchester, South Dakota. Congratulations, Robin. That is awesome. We're so happy for you. And I've communicated with Robin. She's been listening for months, so she's going to be so happy. And I'm so happy that she won. But, you know, it's interesting. I don't know how you're doing this, Kenny, but you've picked two women in a row. Women golf. Woohoo!
Absolutely.
Right on. Okay, but we need to do another giveaway now. We're going to do a two-week giveaway, which means we're going to announce the winner on October 31st, so a nice trick-or-treat present. And what are we going to give away this time?
We're going to give away a fabulous OGO Monster Travel Bag.
Oh, that's perfect for a Golf Smarter listener, because these are the type of people that travel around the country and the world playing golf. And so anybody who wants to get one of these OGO Monster Travel Bags that are about $300, is that what you were telling me?
That is correct, and this thing is unbelievable. It's one of the nicest travel bags I've ever seen.
OGO makes great product.
Oh, they make, go to their, yeah, they make awesome products.
I love their product. So why don't you send an email address to OGO, the subject being OGO, O-G-I-O, and send it to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com, and please include your name and your mailing address. I hate writing back going, come on, give me your mailing address, because if you win, we got to know where to send it. And if you want more information, of course, check the show notes. Again, the winner will be announced in the program of October 31st, 2006, and we'll also announce that day our November shopping special. When your email address is provided to us, we also provide that to Edwin Watts Golf. A little disclaimer there, just to be fair, to let you know that. Send your email to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com with the subject OGO. Kenny, it's been a blast.
It's been a blast, Fred. Take care.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon. Check out Bunkershot.com, the online golf magazine, for news, articles, and more. And please go to Zazzle.com/Fred Green to pick up your set of Golf Smarter postage stamps. We're going to have an announcement pretty soon about something different at Zazzle. But before we close, I need to ask a little selfish favor. Since we changed the URL of our podcast to golfsmarterpodcast.com, iTunes sees us as a new entry and our ranking and popularity has dropped, so that we're no longer the most popular golf podcast. Except I know for a fact that Golf Smarter has more subscribers than the other golf programs, and it makes our sponsor happy. So here's my request to try and straighten things out on iTunes. Could you please go into your podcast folder, select the Golf Smarter podcast, then click on the unsubscribe button? I know it's a really bizarre request, but no, just wait 1 minute and then subscribe again. I'm not asking you to leave. Of course, I want to keep you as a team member, so don't go for good. Just unsubscribe, then subscribe again, and that should straighten everything out. And with all the golf stories that we've discussed in Matt's book today, this kind of reminds me of a great radio story from the 1950s when KSFO Radio had a morning DJ named Don Sherwood. AM Radio and KSFO owned the San Francisco airwaves those days. And to prove it, Don Sherwood would say, okay, everyone, on a count of three, everyone in your car, go ahead and change lanes. And they did. It was supposed to be one of the most outrageous sights on the freeways in California history. We end with our quote of the week, which usually is submitted by you. And if you have a favorite quote that helps keep your head in the game, send an email with the subject, quote, to Fred@GolfSmarterPodcast.com. Now, this week's quote comes from the book we just discussed with Matthew Adams, Fairways of Life. It was Grantland Rice who once said, golf is 20% mechanics and technique. The other 80% is philosophy, humor, tragedy, romance, melodrama, companionship, camaraderie, cussedness, and conversation. Thanks for listening to the Golf Smarter Podcast. I'm Fred Green.